couple of years ago, I was rummaging through a second-hand bookshop, and I came across a book entitled The Alternative Religion by one Wilfred Gale. Rather an arresting title, I thought, so I browsed. Mr. Gale's proposition is that mankind needs a god for his personal and social well-being, but that the god of traditional religion is no longer believable. So he proposes a new god, which he calls the created god. Well, perhaps his terminology was a bit unfortunate, as it's hard to see the most gullible of people giving worship today to a god which they have created themselves, rather than vice versa. It recalls the idolatrous cults of millions of millennia ago, doesn't it? Well, his created god is not a person, but an abstraction, defined as the continuing accretion of individual units of good, arising from small steps of evolution. He has an uncritical acceptance of evolutionary theory, though he sidesteps the whole question of how life began, claiming that such knowledge is unknowable. Though he rejects such ideas as the Trinity, he retains the notion of an immortal soul. Since he recognizes no form of reward or punishment after death, he accommodates his soul in a scheme of reincarnation. And surprisingly, I thought, whilst fulminating at the historical excesses of priesthoods, he nevertheless proposes for his alternative religion an order of clergy, if you like, to teach the new religion and to generally keep an eye on the congregations. It was interesting to see how he had worked out just how his religion would apply to the facets of everyday life. And clearly, he had given a lot of time and thought to the subject. And although he is at pains to suggest that his more enlightened approach would result in a quite utopian society, his regime struck me as pretty authoritarian and right-wing, and it is perhaps significant that he nowhere uses the word love in connection with his created God. And given some of the fallacies of his exposition, it seems unlikely that the alternative religion could ever have many adherents, and I certainly haven't heard of it anywhere else apart from his book. However, I'm not here to expand Wilfred Gale's view, but the title of his book itself suggested an area of inquiry that might be worth pursuing, namely, why is it that so many people today reject Christianity and turn to alternatives? Is it a failing in Christianity itself? Or is it something to do with how we have made Christianity appear? To do this, I'm going to have a look at two systems of thought. First, paganism, and then the variety of belief often known as Celtic spirituality. Again, I'm not here to promote paganism, I'm sure you'll be relieved to know, but since this is currently the fastest growing religion in the United States, and since the cultural detritus of that nation invariably finishes up here, whether it's spam emails or bombing Iraq, I think it is prudent to know at least its outlines. It is certainly quite apparent in this country. Now, some of you may know that Jean and I have a small business called Stratagems, where we actually cut and polish stones, gemstones, which we find ourselves, mostly, and sell as jewellery, and also we sell mineral specimens and polished agates, and a lot of these we sell on stalls at craft fairs, which Jean goes to. So in Stratagems we have therefore frequently come across people who are into the pagan practice of so-called crystal healing. And I should mention that many of the claims for paganism mentioned in the writings of inter alia, Kate and Matthews, are pretty short on valid source references, so I can't be absolutely certain that my descriptions are absolutely accurate. But, interestingly enough, many of the beliefs and practices which pagans embrace do not, as they would claim, go back to ancient times, but are actually quite recent in provenance. And a common, if fairly innocuous, example is the idea of birthstones. Supposedly arcane wisdom, this notion in fact dates only from the early 20th century. Paganism, though, is an old religion. Indeed, its adherents like to talk of Christianity as an apostasy. It was almost wiped out by the Church of Rome using a combination of propaganda, torture, and genocide. Some people held on to the old religion. These were often what were called the wise men and wise women, or witches, the root wit meaning wise, or so they say. Robert Gorman, a director of an organization dedicated to exploring Celtic Christian spirituality, claims, quoting Margot Adler, that this etymological derivation is not supportable. Of course, both sides have axes to grind, though I must say that the Reverend de Gorman does seem to be rather stronger on invective than reasoned argument. However, the Church, the Catholic Church, became impatient with all this and began a purge beginning around 1484, involving the burning of witches and the wholesale slaughter of thousands of people across Europe merely on suspicion of being witches. And this was done, of course, on the authority of Exodus 22, verse 18, "Thou shalt not suffer a witch to live." But there were doubtless other agendas. Not surprisingly, in the face of such persecution, the old religion went underground, and witches dedicated to preserving the religion formed themselves into secret groups called covens. The old religion was virtually extinct, however, by the 1900s, but in 1951 the laws against witchcraft were repealed, and the old practices were revived under the modern name of Wicca. It has become more eclectic and absorbed elements of Hinduism and the Jewish occult system of the Kabbalah. Although Wicca is perhaps the most obvious form of paganism, the term also includes Druidism and Shamanism. And the word witch is, I suppose, still synonymous with wickedness, but the word pagan still rings alarm bells in the minds of many Christians or people in the sub-Christian culture. And why? Because paganism was traditionally the enemy within. The Church of Rome was determined to stamp it out by any means available, and successfully built up an image of evil around pagans, so that even today ordinary people think pagans and or witches sacrifice babies, perform evil spells, and so on. And the Church also used another tactic. It masked out or absorbed pagan celebrations. For example, the Council of Nicaea in 325 persuaded Constantine to move the celebration of the birth of Jesus to that other celebration of the birth of the sun, in Roman times the festival of Mithras, the god of light, at the winter solstice, which was thought in those days to be the 25th of December. For our purposes, it's perhaps helpful to look at the ways in which paganism differs from Christianity. Or perhaps the most fundamental difference is that the Bible sees life and the world as essentially linear, having a beginning and an end, creation to the day of judgment, and beyond the time when God will be all in all. The pagan view, on the other hand, is circular. The endless cycle of the seasons, of death and rebirth. The universe had no beginning, neither will it have an end. As an example of this way of thinking, Christmas celebrates an event which happened 2,000 years ago. Yule celebrates an annually recurring event, the birth of the sun. The Bible informs us that man was made in the image of God. With paganism, the reverse is the case. The pagan gods and goddesses were fashioned in the image of men. Pagan deities are images or symbols of deep-rooted race memories, which Jung called archetypes. Artists may portray them in human form, but that is personal choice. Pagans have no concept of sin or judgment, and no Satan or hell. And it's perhaps just worth mentioning that what's known as Satanism or devil worship is a perversion of Christianity and has nothing to do with paganism. For Christians, the Bible is the guiding rule. Pagans, however, feel they are responsible for their own actions. And it's a bit hard to see how this can give rise to any sort of social cohesion within the group, but maybe this doesn't matter. Most pagans believe in reincarnation in some form. Now, to most of us, I suppose, karma seems like a treadmill, trapping people in endless reincarnations, never free. But pagans see it differently. They see reincarnation as, at its best, a chance to improve or to continue unfinished work. At worst, a simple recycling of souls. Pagans, unlike Christians who place all their hopes on a future life, follow a religion based on a reverence for nature, both in the present and for all time. Pagans see the divine as immanent in the whole of life and the universe, in every tree, plant, animal and object, man and woman, and the dark side of life as well as the light. Pagans claim to live their lives attuned to the cycles of nature, the seasons, life and death. They would also see the deity in female terms just as much as male. Indeed, one of their most important deities is the great maternal earth goddess, often known as Gaia. So, in short, what we are looking at is a continuation of the ancient religion of the Canaanites, without, on the whole, its grosser aspects. Now I need to say something about so-called Celtic spirituality. This covers quite a range of thought, from the overtly pagan to something with at least a superficial connection with Christianity. And it's this end of the spectrum that I want to talk about. Though historical Celtic Christianity retained the orthodox doctrines of a triune God, survival of the soul after death, and so on, it did differ in some significant ways from Catholicism and Protestantism. Perhaps the main point is the belief that God is immanent in nature. Indeed, some Celtic Christians like to refer to the natural world as the fifth gospel. And they would interpret the passage in Genesis referring to the ground being cursed as meaning that it is man's relationship with nature that is cursed and broken, not nature itself, which they insist remains very good. And they like to remind one that the Celts, one of the first peoples to accept Christ, the Galatians, of course, being a Celtic tribe. They perhaps would not like to be reminded of the image of obstinate conservatism, which Paul's letter presents to us as a characteristic of the Galatians. starting with the Romantic period and continuing with a growing revulsion against Western materialism and ecological vandalism. There has been a tendency to romanticize older societies as being utopian. This has given rise to the concept of the noble savage, typified perhaps by the image of the North American Indian, who is seen as a figure of great dignity, totally in harmony with his environment and practicing a monotheistic belief in the Great Spirit. However, more recent and thorough anthropological studies have shown that the North American Indians were in fact not much more enlightened about environmental matters than ourselves. Of course, they lacked the technology to make the devastating impact on the environment that modern man has made, but their societies were not really very utopian at all. The supposed belief in a monotheistic great spirit has been shown to owe more to a wish to ingratiate themselves with Anglo-Saxon missionaries than to any inherent belief. Unfortunately, the ancient Celtic religious communities have similarly been hopelessly romanticized, and their present-day versions so infiltrated by New Age beliefs and practices that it is nigh on impossible to get at what the original was really like. But it is still possible to piece together something of their beliefs, practices, and priorities. First, it was very much a charismatic church. They certainly believed they had spirit gifts, and there are all sorts of stories of miraculous happenings, no doubt liberally embellished by subsequent chroniclers. Healing, prophecy, hospitality, and mercy seem to have been the spiritual gifts they valued most. And it was a Bible-based church, at least up to a point. And they had an especial love for the writings of John and for the Psalms. Much time was spent in copying, studying, memorizing, and teaching scripture. And in some communities, certainly in the community on Iona, and I think some others as well, they had a practice that the Psalms would be sung in the chapel 24 hours a day by a shift system. So all the time the Psalms were being sung. The Celtic church was a mobile church. Times in the quietness of the monastery were seen as a preparation for hectic schedules of evangelism, pilgrimage, and a sacrificial commitment to missionary journeys in imitation of the Apostle Paul. And it was a caring church. The Celtic church encompassed a great care for all of creation, human, animal, and plant. There was a particular concern for the poor, the sick, and the oppressed. Gifts of hospitality and mercy were very much in evidence. This is perhaps best expressed in a couplet attributed to Bridget, who lived in Ireland about AD 500. She wrote, "Jesus Christ and every other person seeing, loving God with every fibre of my being." And it was a praying church. Much time was devoted to contemplative prayer and the development of personal holiness. The hostile environment in which the church existed made the people very much aware of the reality of spiritual evil, and spiritual warfare was part of their prayer life. There didn't seem to be that much emphasis on a personal devil. After all, who needs Satan when you've got the Vikings on your back? With the modern revival of Celtic spirituality, the beliefs of the ancient Celtic church have become mixed with all kinds of particularly 20th century concerns, particularly conservation, militant and aggressive feminism and other aspects of New Age influence. So those beliefs I've described are only partially relevant to the situation we see today. But this brings me to the most important part of what I'm trying to say this morning. Though I haven't heard of much success for Wilfred Gale's doctrine of the created God, there is no doubt that both paganism and Celtic spirituality are rapidly increasing in influence and popularity at the expense of what we would describe as Christianity. What I would like to try to get at is why. Why are people turning away from the gospel and embracing beliefs and philosophies which we, from a Bible perspective, would find unsatisfactory or even absurd? What do people find in these belief systems that they can't find in Christianity? To try and find some answers to this, I'd like to look now at some of the objections that followers of these religions level at Christianity, to see if they are justified, and if they are, what we personally and as a community could do about it. However, I emphasize that it is not for me to suggest answers. I'm merely asking the questions. The fairly sudden awareness that the very planet itself is threatened by the careless and selfish activities of man has made paganism, and to a lesser extent Celtic Christianity, very attractive to the conservation and ecology minded. There is a view, which Celtic Christians would latch onto, that the Protestant Reformation coincided with the upsurge of the idea that nature was there to be dominated and exploited, and that this attitude, coupled with the Industrial Revolution and its Protestant work ethic, is responsible for the mess in which we find ourselves now. The unfortunate King James Version translation of Genesis 1:28 has done much to justify this view, with its encouragement to dominate and subdue nature rather than accept a position of responsible stewardship. We should be in a good position to refute this idea, since, unlike the mainstream churches, their emphasis on heaven, we preach a coming earth when exploitation and ecological rape will be a thing of the past. But obviously, if we are going to make any impact, we have to ensure that our own lifestyles fit into this pattern rather than the pervasive Western style exploitative materialism. Coming back to perhaps relevant to what Ian and Avril were saying last night, we've seen that the Christian churches have been and are seen to be male dominated. While one would perhaps expect this reaction from bodies such as we are looking at, in view of their considerable input from 20th century militant feminism, and while we have to take into account the historically male nature of priesthood, we should be careful to ensure that our position on this subject is truly biblical and does not contain overlooked and unreformed relics of historical Christendom, with its still undetected debt to the Judaizing factions of the early church. That a Judaizing influence is still very much there should be obvious to one familiar with the rituals of the Mosaic Law when observing a Catholic Mass or High Anglican service, with its elaborate symbolic vestments and choreographed movements. The mainstream Christian churches are undoubtedly hierarchical. For various sociological reasons that I won't go into, there are people who like to be shepherded and have an authoritarian figure to do their thinking for them. Others, including the groups we've been considering, find this unacceptable. and whether from pride or from more honest motives, turn away from such institutions to more democratic ones. Some also feel that churches are inherently authoritarian and reactionary, and will always tend to crush those whose outlook, whose aspirations, and whose gifts are somewhat different to what is regarded as the norm. I suppose we would tend to fall more readily into the more democratic category, and should therefore not be subject to this criticism. But I do wonder sometimes. Of course, there is always the danger that strong-willed or charismatic individuals will create their own followings, resulting in something not unlike the authoritarian structures which we would, I hope, join with the radical groups in deploring. Many Christian churches are seen to be lacking in vitality. When a church has been in existence for many centuries, it may find it difficult to maintain a sense of purpose, and hence vitality declines. Many people defect from the mainstream churches because of this. They are often attracted to the superficial vitality of Pentecostal-style churches, with their rather artificial bonhomie and emotional excitement. While Christadelphian ecclesias in other countries frequently show a striking vitality, often in very adverse circumstances, this is now, unfortunately, no longer always the case in Britain for various reasons. Nevertheless, history shows that the average life of Adventist sects is about 100 years. So we're well past the sell-by date. Christadelphian expositors, confidently setting dates for Christ's return, have suffered many disappointments, and we have to be careful that this does not result in a sense of cumulative disillusionment and listlessness infecting the brotherhood. There is a feeling among many who are critical of the churches that they are living in the past. To some extent, I suppose this is inescapable, since events which happened in the past, such as creation, crucifixion, resurrection, are central to the Christian faith, and must always be so. And of course, there are those who prefer an atmosphere ye olden times, perhaps as a company escape from the unpleasant realities of today. But our emphasis on the imminent Second Advent, and our interest in how prophecy relates to present-day events, should put us in a good position to refute the criticism of anachronism. But we can completely undo this by insisting on using a Bible translation in anachronistic English, and worse still, interlarding our everyday conversation with such language. It's an inescapable fact that a message couched in obsolete language is likely to be regarded as therefore itself obsolete. Many people, especially the young, claim to find church services tedious. Some are therefore attracted to what you might call the happy-clappy, pop-orientated cultures of the Pentecostal sects. Others may feel more at home in the groups we've been considering. It's interesting that the Lindisfarne community, a Celtic Christian church, have introduced ceremonial dance into their meetings. I can see nothing wrong with this in principle. After all, we all know about David dancing before the Lord. But I can't see it as anything other than impractical in our staidly Anglo-Saxon ecclesias. Christadelphian meetings tend to cover quite a wide range between what we would call perhaps the left wing and the right wing. This is perhaps a good thing, provided the two persuasions can refrain from sniping at each other and trying to impose what they consider to be right on a congregation which is not comfortable with it. There seems no reason why we should inevitably have to face the charge of tediousness. Our system of a different president and a different preacher each Sunday seems to be a much healthier state of affairs than that obtaining in churches stuck with the same person every week. And the length of talks does not, in itself, it seems to me, really count. A talk lasting 10 minutes can be too long if the speaker is incompetent, while a good speaker can talk for 2 hours and leave you wondering where the time went. Some disaffected ex-Christians accuse the churches of self-seeking and what they describe as navel-gazing. Whether instances of self-seeking are present among us, it isn't for me to say. That can only be a matter between the persons concerned and God. I can only say that I don't see very much evidence of it. I think that by the charge of navel-gazing, most accusing groups mean a preoccupation with theological matters at the expense of concern and care for others, out with or in with the church. Perhaps in the past we might have been somewhat guilty of this. At present, I think, and on the strength of what we've heard this weekend, on the whole, I think we don't have much of a case to answer. The fact that we tend not to advertise our good works must be in accordance with the commandment of Jesus, even if it doesn't bring us adulatory headlines. And by navel-gazing is meant the New Testament injunction to examine ourselves. Then I don't think in all conscience that we should avoid this. Ritual. Many people have found the ritual of particularly the Catholic Church a big turn-off. Yet it is just such ritual which others find attractive. I think I would draw a distinction between ritual and ceremony. Ritual is an act which represents in symbol some external truth. Ceremony is something which exists in itself. It's a heightened way of doing things. The danger with ritual is that the rite can become more important than the truth embodied in it. So the ritual becomes merely a set routine. The original meaning becomes lost. On the other hand, thinking of every aspect of, say, the memorial service, which we will shortly be experiencing, as a ceremony, seems to me to invest in it a sense of specialness which should prevent it degenerating into mere routine. Regarding ritual itself, Christadelphians only practice 3 ritual acts: baptism, the breaking of bread, and what's the third? Sisters wearing hats. Whether the symbology of the first two is clear and indisputable, as is their obvious importance, whether that can be said of the third, I leave you to decide. But before you do, have a word with Ian and Avril. There is an accusation that the churches just keep things churning on for the sake of it. This happens when a church becomes inward-looking and spiritually incestuous. It seems to me that an ecclesia exists for 2 purposes: the spiritual uplift of its members and preaching, and perhaps welfare. Preaching in what appears to be the particularly barren British corner of the vineyard can certainly be enervating and can drive ecclesias into a kind of spiritual apathy. Yet there are ample opportunities in other parts of the world, as everybody here will know, which can be addressed in some way by the least gifted among us. But if an ecclesia, collectively or as its individual members, abandons all attempts at a meaningful preaching regime, becoming inward looking and keeping things churning on for the sake of it, then I think it is heading for disaster. The Bible makes it clear that worship of false gods, particularly by those who should know better, is detestable to God. However, I repeat that I'm not here to pass judgment on others. Rather, I think we have to ask ourselves what it is about Christianity as it is or has been presented that repels some people. I think we should also ask ourselves what it is about mainstream Christadelphian thought and practice that has given rise to a grouping such as Endeavour, a group which evidently includes a number of at least potentially disaffected Christadelphians. And it's a tragedy that many fine minds, one thinks of such as Rousseau or Voltaire, who have quite naturally rejected what they thought was Christianity, but were unaware that what they were judging was a distortion or even a counterfeit. I have yet to be convinced that there is any workable alternative to the gospel of the kingdom. It seems to me, therefore, that our responsibility must be to undo misconceptions wherever we can and make sure that everything we say, everything we do, and everything we are is the truth.